This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. On yesterday's show, we spoke with experts from the VA and the LGBT Resource Center at UW-Milwaukee. They're among those who are presenting the 5th Annual Mental Health Summit with a focus on issues faced by LGBTQ+ veterans.
The event's keynote speaker is Christine Black. Black is an attorney and the director of military and veteran services at Marywood University in Scranton, Pennsylvania. But before her career in higher education, Black served 9 years in the Army, including 3 deployments.
During her deployment, she served as a unit armorer, an operations supervisor, and an intelligence non-commissioned officer in charge for an aviation task force. Black also served in the closet during Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but she came out after its repeal and during the subsequent backlash.
Today, she speaks to many veterans and higher education groups about how to best serve the veteran community, especially those who are LGBTQ. She joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by phone and recalled the challenges she faced that influenced her career today.
I really struggled when I was in and I served under Don't Ask, Don't Tell with counseling my soldiers who might have been in maybe not the healthiest relationships with anything to do with their relationship because that was so hypocritical, I felt.
Right. And it sounds like even with issues outside of relationships and being closeted just with Army and mental health, that you all supported each other and you knew what was going on with one another. But to have to be closeted and not be able to speak about certain issues with your fellow soldiers, was there a space at the time where you could be out safely or a certain group of people? Did people find a way to get around Don't Ask, Don't Tell while still feeling supported?
Don't Ask, Don't Tell created this really interesting conundrum where the only way you could comply with the rules was to break the rules. And it resulted in, and this is my personal assertion based on friends who were in similar circumstances to me and based on what I saw as a member of an advocacy group for LGBT service members, where we were kind of like, we're already in violation, so does it really matter if I violate this rule over here? And so you saw a lot of enlisted officer relationships because you were kind of like, damned if I do, damned if I don't. But I was very lucky. I started playing rugby around 2008, and there were a lot of military gays in rugby.
Yeah.
A lot of military, there's a lot of gays, there's a lot of people that fit inside that Venn diagram. And so I found other people that were like me, and it really helped me navigate because for the first couple years that I was in, I didn't date because I didn't want to be hypocritical. And when I came home from Iraq the first time, my attitude was kind of like, if I can watch my friends die, I can date who I want. And I kind of danced on the edge for a couple of years. I was very lucky that I had a unit that kind of thought the whole thing was stupid. I was living in Nevada at the time where, conservatism was very close to libertarianism, where it was very much like, don't tell me what you're doing and I won't tell you what I'm doing. And so my then girlfriend came to unit events and knew my unit commander and came to barbecues as my roommate. I served for 7.5 years under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I think the last year that I was deployed, which was entirely without Don't Ask, Don't Tell, was probably the worst year. And I was the deepest in the closet.
It was repealed.
Yeah. So I had a commander that I absolutely loved, and I went to him the day that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed, and I was extending on with the next unit, and they were due to come in any day. And I think it was September 20th that the repeal happened, and they were landing like October 5th or something. And I went to my commander, and I said, sir, I'm gay. And he looked at me, and he goes, well, Sergeant Black, I've kind of been assuming that. And I said, well, in 5 minutes when I punch chief, I need you to know what happened. And my chief had taken the front page of the newspaper that they produce overseas, which had an airman kissing his husband at midnight, and he was throwing darts at it and talking about what they should do with the queers. Mm. And my commander stepped in and handled that situation, and about 2 days later, my unit had a non-discrimination policy. But what a lot of people don't realize is there was no non-discrimination policy when Don't Ask, Don't Tell ended. And I was dealing with, as a member of OutServe, which is the advocacy group I mentioned earlier, I was dealing with soldiers who had been outed by their command who thought they were helping. Mm. And people who had made assumptions about soldiers under their care that were not correct. And so the first couple of days were kind of just a mess. And my commander went to the airport to pick up the incoming command for the unit that I was extending on with. And he came back and he called me into his office and he said, "You need to go back in the closet." Hmm. And I was like, "What?" And he said, "You know, I told them you're my kid. I'll protect you. I will fly back here and kick their butts if they do anything to you. But the unit's from Mississippi. They're not exactly the most progressive. No offense to them. I love the people in that unit, but it was just, it's a cultural thing. My safe space in Nevada was very different than my safe space in Maryland. It was very, very different than my safe space with Mississippi. So the safe spaces were there, but you had to know enough to navigate them, and you had to take very close note of your command. I have a friend who got investigated because she wasn't sleeping with anyone in her unit on deployment. And that was enough under Don't Ask, Don't Tell to get you investigated.
Wow. Yeah, and it sounds like the effect on team dynamics is particularly hard. And it's surprising to hear you say that it was worse after it was repealed, because you've established a dynamic and a trust and a group mentality with your units, but then all of a sudden it gets changed.
Very much so. And one of the things I always try to emphasize when I'm talking about this issue is that no matter how close you were to your unit, no matter how good a friend you were with your squad mate, there was always a risk. And you had to live like that. And, you know, they talk a lot about the brotherhood, and they talk a lot about, like, trusting people that you've gone downrange with. And I do. And I'm getting married later this year, and a number of people from each of my deployments are going to be there. But when I came out, I had to go back and apologize to people that had mentored me, that I hadn't actively lied to them, but I had been in a situation where I could never be honest with them. I could never be completely honest with my squad mates. And when I was completely honest with my squad mates, I was putting myself at risk. Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the policy said that investigation could be initiated pretty much for any reason. And it could be initiated by anyone who had a suspicion.
Well, and I imagine this also takes a toll on you and other LGBTQ people who have served or are veterans mentally. The fact that you have to still do your job well and have a good rapport with the people you serve with and risk your lives with, yet, as you mentioned, you can't be completely open. So is the LGBTQ plus veteran population affected more with mental health issues and mental health care compared to the straight counterparts?
I would say absolutely. When I talk about veterans issues, that one of my pet peeves, because I work mostly in higher education, is that a lot of campuses include PTSD in their personal definitions of veterans. It's not necessarily written in, but there's always this assumption when they're dealing with a veteran that the person has PTSD. And I always try to emphasize, we're just socialized similarly. The ROTC cadet who's been through basic training, the guy who did 20 years active duty, the National Guardsman who's been in for 8 years, we're socialized to a certain standard. And LGBTQ veterans, even more than traditional veterans, are socialized to a certain standard and to a certain aloofness. I really struggled. My law school was very liberal. We had a lot of vets. We also had a very big LGBTQ population. And I was, for a couple years, kind of the bridge between them. We had other members of the community that fit in both, but most of them either worked with one group or the other. They didn't want to be both. And it creates this dichotomy in how you see yourself, and it's very difficult to reconcile those two labels in your head and realize how issues from one can impact issues from the other. And it's an area that not a lot of people are educated on, so you might be getting treatment and they're not realizing the underlying triggers that are going along with that. One of the things I talk a lot about when I present to vet groups is what a microaggression is and how the buildup of microaggressions throughout the military service, even if you were not out, can cause these huge underlying issues for a veteran that falls into this population. And so you might be treating them the most effective way you know to handle whatever it is arising from their deployment, whether it be a spiritual, emotional, mental injury, but you're not dealing with the underlying agitator, which comes from the LGBTQ portion of their personality.
With your work in veteran services and in higher education, since you've had the perspective of both an active duty and now taking care of other veterans and being a veteran yourself, what do you think is needed most, in your opinion, both services for when you are active duty and then the support that should follow?
So I wrote this paper in law school arguing that professional military education should include training on mediation and negotiation. And part of my argument was that we're expected to interact with all these different cultures and all these different personalities, and we're never really taught how to handle. We're just told, treat them equally. And I don't think it takes anything away from the Army's warfighting mission, and I don't think it takes anything away from the edge for the Marines to teach them to deal with other humans as humans during the process. I think that would reduce a lot of the agitation around the LGBT community serving openly and eventually, hopefully, around the trans community being able to serve openly and safely. The question of its funding, given the current political climate, is up in the air. The VA had a good program for a little while where they were bringing in people on fellowships to deal with LGBTQ issues. I don't think the Army, the Marines, the Navy, I don't think any of them can come up with a perfect program on their own. I think a lot of it's going to have to come from outside the service, but from people like me who understand the culture. I'm very much a person who believes that you can only tear the system down from the inside when you understand how everything works and can replicate the services it performs. So I don't believe that either civilians can impose something on the services that is going to make this the perfect fit, or that the military can figure it out on their own. And I think there needs to be collaboration among the mental health providers currently serving and the mental health providers serving the people who've gotten out to understand the impact this has had just long term. Right now, we are getting the first generation of vets who served entirely openly. Don't Ask, Don't Tell ended September 20th. You could go to basic a little bit before that as an openly serving person. It's now a little over 3 years after that, and a lot of people are starting to complete their first terms of service. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the veteran community responds to that, because a lot of the motivation for any of these programs, for more services within the VA, for retention programs that keep everyone around instead of just certain groups of people, all of that's going to come from within the veterans community seeing the problem. The end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell didn't come from within the services as much as we like to say it did. It came from the vets who got out and thought that this is something that needs to change.
Right. And do you think that the current political climate, even with all the advances of the past, is there a fear of regression for
Absolutely.
Just veterans or people involved in these programs?
Absolutely. I am actually in the process of applying to go back in as JAG. And when the current administration was elected, I had to drop my packet about 6 days before the election. And when the current administration was elected, I almost withdrew my packet because I knew that there were things in my packet that identified me as LGBTQ. And I did not want that coded into an Army record somewhere, which I realize is slightly paranoid. But I think the feeling within my community is that we've gained so much ground, but it's entirely erasable. And I say that as an attorney, understanding how the courts can protect if needed, how legislatures can protect it needed. One of the things I always try to remind people in my speeches is that LGB portion of the population served either entirely before Don't Ask, Don't Tell and entirely before social acceptance, under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but before social acceptance, under Don't Ask, Don't Tell with social acceptance, or now, like I said, we're just graduating that first group. But my trans family is still serving essentially under Don't Ask, Don't Tell and is serving without social acceptance. And every time they erode one right from a group, it's opening the door to erode other rights and acceptances and social abilities from the rest of the group.
Which really highlights the importance of the summit coming up, such as the one you're speaking at, with your work as well, speaking with other people and other organizations. How important is it to just simply talk and educate people, not just for the LGBTQ veterans who need access and need education on what's available to them, but the wider population as a whole?
I think it's incredibly important. I gave this presentation that was talking about some programming a friend of mine had done with me based around the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and it was jointly put on by his veteran center and his LGBTQ center. And when he called me, I was amazed. I was like, wow, you guys work together. And it kind of blew my mind. And then we went to this conference and we talked about it. And we had so many people in the room who were like, oh, wow, I had never thought of that. And there is a tendency within the veterans community to hire people based on their veteran status rather than an essentially demonstrated ability to do the job. Especially within higher ed, we have a tendency to hire people who fit our mental picture of veterans. And so you don't necessarily have people who are used to dealing with feelings and who are used to dealing with people who are not like them or who are educated on how to serve people equally. And so we started out this programming, and about halfway through, this guy's hand shot up and he's like, I have a stupid question. And I was like, there's no stupid questions in here. What's your question? And he said, how do I apologize if I say something wrong? Like, just apologize. And he's like, no, like, what do I say? And so I took him through a role play and we talked about it a little bit. And at the end of the session, I had 8 people come up to me and say, that was my question for you. And it's one of those things that you sometimes forget as you start finding people who are like-minded. You sometimes forget to reach back and pull your squad mate with you. And some of these guys that were saying that to me at the end of the session are very good friends of mine. Some of them are invited to my wedding. And they didn't know how to ask me that question. Just how do I apologize if I misgender someone? And so spreading that word, educating everyone in the community, whether that's what is the correct way to gender someone, what is the correct way to apologize, whether that's a deeper issue of how do I contribute to the conversation going on around that, sometimes you have to reach back and pull your squad mates with you because otherwise they're not going to know that they're missing out on the conversation.
Right, back to basics so you can deal with the problems that affect all of you collectively.
Exactly. I went to another conference last week and somebody asked me what the difference between a cadet and a veteran was, and I almost had a meltdown. But the person doesn't deal with veterans on their campus. They don't know what the difference is. And it was just one of those things that is so essential and so offensive to any veteran who has found themselves lumped with a cadet on campus that it's funny to me, but you forget sometimes that not everybody knows what you know. And not everybody will take away from the speech the exact same thing that you took away from the speech.
Well, we certainly look forward to having you speak here in Milwaukee. And I want to thank you, Christine, for your service and also for your time today and talking about it.
Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you guys in a couple of days.
Christine Black is an Army veteran and is currently the Director of Military and Veteran Services at Marywood University in Pennsylvania. She'll be the keynote speaker at the Zablocki VA Medical Center's 5th Annual Mental Health Summit at UWM on Friday. It's free and open to the public, and you can find more information at WUWM.com.